Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of this Forum Chatter podcast. First, I want to start off saying that everyone, wherever you listen, if you could please just subscribe, whether it's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever it is. And if anyone's interested in sponsoring the show or getting in touch to support the show or if anything else, please send me an email. It's forumchatter@gmail.com. It should be in the show's description. So for this episode, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Martina Mampieri, who is a Martin Buber Fellow at the Hebrew University. And we're going to be discussing, the topic is going to be her book, which was published last year, which is called Living Under the Evil Pope, the Hebrew Chronicle of Pope Paul IV by Benjamin Nechemya ben Elnathan from, I'm not going to pronounce his name right, Svetanova, I think I assume it's Marche, but I don't know. In the 16th century, this was published by Brill Publishers. So with that, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
By the way, how do you pronounce the city over there?
Civitanova Marche. Yeah.
Okay. There we go. That's the proper pronunciation. So I think to start off, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. As you can listen from my accent, I'm from Italy. I grew up in Rome. I studied in Rome at the Sapienza University. So has a bachelor, I did my bachelor and master in a history of religions. And that's why I got interested in a Jewish history. And then I continued with a PhD, with a double PhD program between the University of Roma III and the University of Hamburg. And I graduated in 2017 with a dissertation on Paul IV and this Hebrew chronicle on Paul IV by Benjamin ben Elnathan from Civitanova Marche. And after that, I started traveling quite a lot. In 2018, I first got a short-term postdoctoral fellowship to do individual research in Jerusalem, where I work at the Ben Zvi Institute on Isaiah Zonne's library. Then I work in the National Library. And after these 6 months, I collaborated with the IRHT, the Institut de Recherche d'Histoire des Textes in Paris, for about 5 months on a different project, which was funded by the Rothschild Foundation. And it was aimed to the digital edition of the Sefer HaShorashim by David Kimchi. And after that, and still in 2018, I got the Aristar Fellowship at Harvard. So I spent 1 year in Cambridge. And in 2019, I moved back to Europe, and this time to Göttingen at the Lichtenberg College of the University of Göttingen. I would say 3 weeks ago, I moved to Jerusalem. So yeah, about a month ago, I moved to Jerusalem, and I'm now a Martin Buber Fellow at the Hebrew University. Yeah, this is my path.
Okay, very, very interesting. So like we said, we got to the, so I think what, I guess something over there, maybe is it being Italian? What exactly, we'll get to the subject, obviously there's a lot to discuss, but what, you know, attracted you to this subject? What drew you to research this and to write a book on it eventually?
Yeah, so as an undergraduate, I was mostly interested in the history of the church or history of Christianity, and both in the West and East. And then I really started working on, I became passionate about Hebrew language. So first biblical Hebrew and then modern Hebrew. And I started working on Jewish sources from different time and different places. And that's why I wrote my master thesis on the sixth part of the Sefer Yochasin by Abraham Zahuto. And so I really became intrigued by Jewish historiography in the between the 15th century, the last part of the 15th century, and the beginning of the 16th century. So that's why I started working not only specifically on Italian history, Italian Jewish sources, but I would say sources of, that were talking about the writing of history, they could tell us a lot about what Jews thought about history and how they wrote about their own history, but also the history of non-Jews. I mean, of Christians and Muslims. So that's why, I mean, I started reflecting on the importance of history after the diaspora, after the Galut Sfarad. So in 1492, because Zacuto was one of the people was really really moved from Spain to Portugal, and from Portugal it was also expelled in 1496. Then it was captured by the pirates in Tunis, and he had quite a lot of troubles during his time. Yeah, I would say this was part of my master interests, and I'm still on track. I'm still working on historiography.
Wow, it's fascinating. So I think we should start off before the book, really, and I guess set the stage for, 16, really late 15th century, early, you know, the 16th century. This is really the middle of the 16th century, but to, you know, of the papal states versus the city-states of Italy, and what that means, and Italian Jewry as a whole, and just explain that to the listeners before we get into the book.
Yeah, that's really important, and it's not easy at all. So I will try to be clear and keep things simple, because Italy didn't exist back then. So Italy, as we know today, didn't really exist back in the 15th century, 16th century. So we had lots. So the geography is very much, it's very complex, because we have the state of the church and corresponding today to several regions. So it was pretty much a large territory that corresponds today to the region of Lazio, Marche, and Umbria, a part of Emilia and Romagna. So regions in Italy, mostly in the city center, in the center of Italy, and then up to the north, to the Adriatic Sea. And then we had the Kingdom of Naples, and then the Kingdom of Sicily, and the Kingdom of Sardinia, that were all under the influence of the of Spain, so under the Habsburg family. And of course, I forgot to say that this is the geography we had in 1559. So after the treaty of the peace treaty of Cato Cambresi, at the end of the Italian Wars. So the Italian Wars were wars fought by between the Habsburg family and the Valois family in France, from Spain, and the Emperor and France, because they all of them wanted a piece of Italy. They wanted to have the control over the regions. So this war, they finally had their hand in 1559, which is the same date, the same year of Paul IV's death. And in 1559, so we have the state of the church, then we have the Kingdom of Naples and Sardinia and Sicily under the influence of Spain. We have in the north, the Duchy of Savoy, which was under the emperor, and then we have the Grand Duchy of Tuscany, the Duchy of Milan, which was also under the influence of Spain, and then we have independent republics of Genoa and Venice. But there were lots of other states and mini states governed, ruled by duchies and marquises and whatever. All over, so we have Mantua and Parma and Piacenza, Ferrara, Modena, Reggio, Urbino. All these cities the names of the cities are familiar, because we know about the Jewish presence, and we know the family names of many Jewish people who came from these cities. So It's this city is exactly where inhabited by Jews since a very long time. So the Jewish presence in Italy, what we call Italy, and I use Italy in this context, the Jewish presence in Italy was deeply rooted, not only in the state of the church, which was all the papal state, it's the same, but they were everywhere. So since the Middle Ages, but even before, there were Jews, Roman Jews, they are claiming to be before to be in Rome before Christianity arrived, and this is true. So the Roman, while the Roman Jewish community was the most ancient of them all, there were other communities, important communities, or communities all over the territories. So in the Middle Ages, and we don't have only the Jews who came from Jerusalem, we have Jews who came from the north, because they were expelled by France and Germany in the end, I mean, after the Black Plague, the Black Death in 1348, they were accused of being, having brought the plague. So they were expelled by France and so Ashkenaz, let's say that. So we have Ashkenazic Jews in the north of Italy. We have Sephardic Jews who came after, who came from Spain and Portugal after the expulsions in 1492 and 1496. We have Levantine Jews who came from the east. We have the Italian Jews, the Roman Jews, who were claiming to be the true Italian. So it's very complicated to talk about Jews in general, Italian Jews, because who was really Italian? What were the features and the characteristics? Also because they were speaking different languages, they were having different rites, so different minagim. So it was really a complex and variegated community. Community of communities. Yeah.
Right. And I think right, a lot of communities had three shuls. They had a Sephardi shul, Ashkenaz shul, and Italian shul. Also wanted to throw in that the emperor you mentioned is the Holy Roman Emperor from Germany, Austria. So that should be mentioned. And another thing that I alluded to is that in Naples and Sicily, which was under Spanish control influence, there was no Jews at this time living there, right? They were only in the Papal States and in the city states to the north.
Yeah. So again, as it happened in Spain, also the Jews from the Kingdom of Naples were under Spain, were expelled in 1492, 1493, 94. We had several expulsions from the Kingdom of Naples. So these Jews were coming up to the north and to the region of Marche. So I would say that, you know, the Kingdom of Naples was not only Naples. So it was pretty much big territory corresponding today to Campania, to the region of Campania and Abruzzo mostly, and Molise. So these people were, these Jews were expelled, came to the north, and they dwelled by the border. I would say in the lower part of the Marche. Marche was also part of the state of the church, and Jews were welcome there to stay, because of course that was also the problem that since the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, Christians couldn't lend money. So that's why we have the business of money lending in the Papal States in the Middle Ages, and we have the flourishing of many, many communities around the figure of a moneylender in every city. And that's why Jews managed to move from Spain and to relocate to other places in the state of the church. And this is also what happened to the author of the Chronicle, Benjamin Ben Elnathan.
Right. So the other thing I would mention is that we mentioned a lot of geography. The geography is the same. Anyone can go on Google Maps and any of these cities will be in these locations that you mentioned. So you can see where they are still today, and you'll understand, you'll get a feel of what's going on. So just look on Google Maps still, and you can put in the city still in the same place. A lot of probably even has some of the same architecture, right, as back then even. Okay, so I think one of the things we should give an overview of before we actually get into the actual book, I mean, this is tied to the book, is an overview of the popes of the late 15th century, early 16th century, and their attitude towards the Jews. There were some good popes, the Medici popes, Leo and Clement, especially, in my understanding. And then there were some like Pope Paul, which were pretty horrible. So why don't we set the table until we get to him, and then we'll get into him.
Yeah, so, you know, the attitude towards the Jews was not always the same. And they were, it's ups and downs. It really much depended on the Pope of the moment. So there were some popes who were more benevolent towards Jews, and they were showing much more favor than others. And mostly, I would say that still in the Renaissance and in the 14th, 15th century, some popes were really interested into the arts, and they were hiring people, they were hiring Jews as artists, as musicians in the courts. So they also had a private relationship with the Pope. So they were not just considered workers, but they, some way, they also had interactions with the Popes themselves. And this is the case, for example, of Leo. So Pope Leo X, Medici, was having a Jewish physician. And lots of popes were having Jewish physicians. It was not the same. It was not the only one. But this is one of the many examples. And I think this is more linked to the fact that many popes were interested into the arts, were into mecenatism, and they were more open to other cultures. While in the 16th century, of course, the situation changes with Paul IV, and we'll talk about it. Other popes before him were still somehow showing their favor, sometimes not. Oh, sometimes they were just fine with the Jews, but they were not pushing for conversion, or were not enforcing particular laws against the Jews. We have, in the case of the Chronicle of Benjamin, we have information about other popes, not only Paul IV. So Benjamin, the author of the Chronicle, talks about other popes before him, before Paul IV, saying that in the case of Marcellus II, he saved the Jews, and it was, even though it reigned only for 21 days, he saved the Jews from the blood, from something. He doesn't say exactly what. He says, he was sat shua gedula l'Israel. Why? And in my book, I say that Marcellus II saved the Jews from the blood libel accusation in 1555. We have some previous knowledge about this accusation, although there we don't have proofs of a trial against Jews in 1555, but apparently Marcellus, there are other Jewish sources who can confirm this. So we have information about Pius IV, who was Paul I's successor, and he was elected in 1560. And Pius IV was giving a speech. He gave a speech to the Jews and to the Roman people, and after the death, after his election, which was really a big deal after four years of Paul I's pontificate. And in his speech, he really wanted to know the Jews, that he was considering them, and he wanted to show his favor towards them. after all what happened in the pontificate of Paul the First. So, you know, there is the behavior of the church, the attitude of the church towards the Jews really changed, and during the times, through the centuries, and it really depended on the popes and on the pope itself, himself. So yeah, we should really look at the specific pontificates. But again, Paul the First, it was exactly a milestone, and it was really a turning point in the history of relations between Jews and Christians in the 16th century.
Right, and so to mention the Pope, I think Marcellus, you said his name, was the one with the blood libel. So I think Yosef HaKohen in Emek HaBacha discusses that. Also, one of the historical sources, Reuven Robert Bonfield just put out a new edition of that. Emek HaBacha said that he does discuss that, makes mention, and you discuss it in the chapter. I should just say now already, I guess, your book has a few chapters of introduction, of discussing various things, and then it has a critical edition of Hebrew with an English translation of the Chronicle, and it also has colored pictures of the whole facsimile of the manuscript. So we'll get more into the book. So Pope Paul the Fourth, who I'm probably going to butcher his name again in Italian, so I'll let you say what his original name was and where he came from and his whole history. So why don't we go with his background, his history, you know, and then up until, or you can even go continue with his, you know, the overview of his pontificate.
Yeah. So Paul I was born as Gianpietro Carafa in 1476 to one of the most important and noble families from Naples, the Carafa family. He received his religious education and then received the sacred orders. And he moved to Rome thanks to his uncle, who was a cardinal, Cardinal Oliviero Carafa. And he was introduced to the Roman Curia. And since he was a young priest and then bishop, archbishop in Naples, he really devoted his life to fight the enemies of the church. No matter if they were Protestant, if they were Catholic, if they were Jews, Muslims, he was really devoting his life to whom he thought they were the enemies. In 1542, along with another cleric, Gaetano dei Conti de Thiene, he became saint afterwards. He founded the Congregation of Clerics Regular, or Theatines. And this order was based on vows of chastity, obedience, and poverty. And Paul the Fourth was observing this very strict life, a monastic life, even after he became a cardinal. He never abandoned this strict monastic life in the convent. And since he was a cardinal, he was interested. The more he grew in power, the more he invested in the reformation, the moral reformation of the church, and because it was really fighting, complaining, I would say, about the moral of many cardinals and many bishops who many times were found fathers of babies around the court, around the papal states. So, and it, of course, this happened after the Protestant Reformation. So many bishops, many priests and cardinals were indulging in the Protestant Reformation. And in some way, he didn't really, when he also participated to the council to make sure that the Protestant Reformation would So yeah, I mean, it's very complicated. So I will try to be more simple. So it was fighting against the Protestant Reformation, and people inside the church and inside the Catholic Church who were sympathizing with the Lutheran ideas. So still on the same in the same project, it did many things, and it was working on the very big project was the strengthening of the Roman Inquisition on the model of the Spanish one. It was really pushing the Pope, Paul the Third, to move on with the strengthening of the Inquisition, and then finally, in 1542, the bull Licet ab initio was the starting point of the new Inquisition, the new Roman Inquisition. So the Inquisition did, you know, many, many things against the Jews, although Jews were not inside the Catholic realm, so were not baptized, so they were not to be considered heretics. But nonetheless, the church find a way, the church and Paul the Fourth, that back then was Cardinal Carafa, and he was the Inquisitor General of the Roman Inquisition, found a way to take care also of the Jews as one of the targets of the Roman Inquisition. Then in 1553, we have the burning of the Talmud in Campo dei Fiori in Rome. And this was one of the points that Paul IV was really interested in, because it really thought that with the physical elimination, the physical annihilation of the Talmud, Jews were finally open to conversion. So on Rosh Hashanah of 1553, so on the 9th of September, he ordered to gather all the books of the Talmud in Rome in the marketplace of Campo dei Fiori, where also Giordano Bruno was burned. So the philosopher Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake there in the first January of 1600. And still today we saw the statue of Giordano Bruno, and also the plaque of remembering the burning of the stake in 1553 of the books. And this was totally, I would say, unexpected by the Jews, because they received only 30 years before, Bamberg had printed the Talmud in Venice. So these and many other things were the result of the hard work of Paul IV, Gian Pietro Carafa, before it became Paul IV. And this happened in 1555, when he was elected in 1555, although it was still, it was already very old, it was 78 or something. And he became Pope after a very short pontificate of Marcellus II, I mentioned before. And no one really was really thinking that Paul IV could have accepted the pontificate. But in the end, he accepted the pontificate, and he ruled for 4 years in a very strict way. And we can consider one of the worst pontificates in terms of relationships and rights to the Jews, of the Jews, but not only of the Jews, because the pontificate was really a turning point, was a milestone for many people in terms of expression, rights, and I will explain more. I'm sure we'll talk about it more later.
Yeah. Right, right. So, I mean, do you want to get into now also the other things that he, you know, how he started off his papacy when he, with the bull that he issued to against the Jews, target the Jews, and the other things that happened, and then we can delve into the chronicle, which discusses a lot of this as well. Obviously, a lot of, I guess we'll preface by saying a lot of what we're going to discuss now is mentioned in the chronicle in detail by an eyewitness to a lot of things and someone that lived in the Papal States, but maybe you want to at least start off with while we're talking about him a little bit, Paul, just to explain a little bit about how he started off his papacy.
Yeah, so he was elected. So Paul I was elected in May 1555. And its first act in his pontificate was the issue of the Communis Absurdum, a bull that really changed the whole situation for the Jews. Although many of the laws in the bull were not new, but I would say it was the first time that all the laws against the Jews were gathered together, and they to create, let's say, a package, a complete package against the Jews. So there are many. There were 14 laws, and many of them were, again, were not new. They were already issued in the Middle Ages. So, for example, the imposition of the yellow badge. And this was something from the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215. And so Jews were obliged to wear the yellow badge on their clothes so that people could recognize them. But many other new impositions, for example, the order of having only one synagogue. You can imagine that in a community, in a city, where you have not only many Jews, but you have Jews from different rites, different minagim, different languages. How is it possible to destroy the synagogues and decide, okay, we will have only one synagogue? And this is what happened in Rome, because there were at least five different communities and five different communities with different languages and rites and everything. So we have in Rome the Piazza delle Cinque Scuole. So it's a place, and it's called after the Cinque Scuole, so the five Talmud Torah that were there in 1555 in the ghetto. So in the same building, as a way of compromise, they had to, so the Jews in Rome had to choose one building and put all the synagogues in one building. So it was not easy. But this, of course, was the situation in Rome. What about many other cities where there were many other communities, there were communities that were already split. So this imposition really caused lots of troubles, because of course Jews didn't want to renounce to their synagogues. Other impositions were mostly economic, because this bull was really aimed at destroying the Jews, from destroying the economic conditions and wealth of the Jews. And also there were deprived. So according to that, Jews couldn't practice medicine, couldn't practice the arts and many, many different jobs. But they were forced, according to the bull, were forced only to practice the strazzeria, seu cenceria. So it means the business of rags, trade rags and clothes. And so this really caused lots of economic issues and inside and outside the ghetto. And the ghetto, which is the thing that really was another imposition and was the first result of this bull. So the bull really marked the physical separation, the segregation of the Jews in Rome than in the rest of the Papal States, where ghettos were established later. I mean, later that year and the following years. And all the social life was had to be thought in a different way. So how to get into the ghetto, how to get out, what was the role, what was life inside the ghetto, and what was the relationship with the Jews and non-Christians, and with Christians. So the ball was really talking about everything. This ball was also preventing the Jews to be servants for the Christians, or to have servants. And also another point was the prohibition of conversations between Jews and Christians. And we have many proofs that Jews and Christians were not only talking to each other, but they were playing to each other. They were having food. They were having social interactions. Sometimes they were having sex. So, you know, this ball was really, in the very beginning, was not welcomed by the Jews with the, I would say, awareness or full understanding. So in the very beginning, Jews were thinking that not all the rules would have been applied so strictly. And also were not believing that the ghetto was being established so fast, and the construction of the ghetto was really immediate. So many, many things. I mean, this ball was just the starting point of a long change. I mean, a long change, but that happened in such a short time, because the pontificate of Paul I was only 4 years and a couple of months. Yeah. And again, I mean, it's very much complicated to talk about the ball in detail. But yeah.
No, I'm just jumping. I think that's good. And the chronicle does begin more or less with discussing the bull and outlining all of the parts of it. I just want to make two points here to jump in. First of all, as we said, the bull did not affect really the Jews in Venice, all the Jews in that were not under the Papal States. So not the entire Italy as we know it today was affected necessarily. The other thing I wanted to say, I know this might be a very simple question, but I'm sure there'll be listeners listening and be like, what is a bull? So I think we should just simply like the just simple definition for people, what it how you would define it.
Yeah, it's a law. It's a bulla in Latin, and it means just a letter and order that the Pope issue with some immediate effect. So, and they were, every time Jews, every time Popes had to communicate something to the Jews, it happened through the bulls, oftentimes, yes.
So I think before we get into the actual chronicle itself and the book itself, I think one last thing we should mention, it's actually, I think, the second chapter, the second parak of the chronicle, and the third and the fourth, I think, something like that. And it's a very important, unfortunately, part of Paul the Fourth's papacy, which is the burning at the stake in Ancona, in Italy, of the conversos, Moranos, whatever you want to call them, 24 of them. It's a horrible story at the Auto de Fe, and it's repeated in pretty vivid detail in the chronicle. So why don't you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So our author, Benjamin, it was an eyewitness of the burning of the stake of 27 Marranos, so conversos that in the chronicle he also mentions as Marranos in a negative way. Negative way as they were called by the church. So these conversos were mostly Portuguese and Sephardic people that who settled in Ancona in the end of the 15th century. We don't know exactly about the identity of people. We can track the names, and we have the names written in the chronicle. We can we have also some records of the wealth that were confiscated by the Roman Inquisition in 1555 and 1556. So we can have an idea of who these people were. So in the chronicle, the author talks about 26 or 27, if 26 men and one woman named Meiora. And it talks about the burning at the stakes in several phases. So some people were burned in the beginning of 1556, and others at a later stage. And it's very much possible that the chronicler was in Ancona in that time, and he saw what he wrote in the chronicle. Several times he said, I've written this because I saw it, my ears listened to these words exactly. I saw the blood of a man one of the prisoners who took his life because he didn't want to die at the stake. So he said, I saw the corpse of this poor Portuguese man, and I saw the blood. So there are many instances of the chronicle where the author talks about these Portuguese conversos in Ancona. So what does it mean? Who were these Portuguese conversos? So again, Ancona was a very important city for trade. And it was on the port, it has a harbor. And the Jews, the Levantines, they were both Levantine Jews from the East and Sephardic Jews. So the Sephardic Jews were not exactly sometimes Jews because they received baptism. So that's why the Catholic Church saw these Portuguese conversos as true Catholics, even though they were not Catholic at all. They were not really practicing, they were not worshiping Christianity. They couldn't consider themselves Catholics. They were still Jewish, and they were practicing Judaism. So these people were received some grants and received some privileges by some other popes before Paul the Fourth, so Julius the Third and Paul the Third. They granted privileges and also considered them to keep worshiping God, the law of Moses. Let's say that. But Paul the Fourth changed his mind in 1556, declared that these people were heretics because they were baptized in Spain and Portugal. And when they came to Italy, they had to be considered, that when they came to Ancona, they still had to be considered Catholics. So we have what happened in 1556 is considered one of the worst things happened to the Jews in Italy ever. And of course, I mean, after what happened in the Second World War, but yeah.
Right, and I think just before we move on to the actual chronicle, I wanted to read a little bit from the chronicles open in front of me. I think it's very poignant. People, I think listeners would appreciate hearing how he reads that kulam anashim chasidim kedoshim shemasru ba'atzmam al kiddush Hashem umidei avrum leleches al amokim hamuchim lesarfasam hayleichshim b'fiyam yichad Hashem. So your translation said that they were pious people, holy people, and they passed the place where they're supposed to go. They be burned. They whispered in their mouths about the unity of God. And it says further that even if they only spoke Italian, they said spoken in Italian. There's actually a very beautiful piece from, it says, Reb Shlomo Yichya. he gave a whole a speech why they were dying on Kiddush Hashem, and it's really poignant. It's a beautiful, yeah. In a sad way, obviously, in a very terribly sad way. And it talks about how he's Makadosh. He made the and he they said Shema, and then he made a bracha on Kiddush Hashem, and he fell into the fire and he died. And right after this, the chronicle says, Paul. Basically, he said he'll be cut out and annihilated from the earth. He really heaped, I mean, there's a lot of curses, you know, Yamakshma heaped on Paul, the whole chronicle. But I don't read that properly. I just wanted to tell people it's very moving, unfortunately, that whole scene. So I think we should get to the chronicle, enough of that. So the chronicle, you know, which is the focus, you know, you've mentioned the author's name, which is Binyamin Nechemiah ben Elnatan. Who was he? Where was he from? You know, and then why he write the chronicle, what was the purpose, and all of those questions that follow from that.
So as I said before, so he came from the Kingdom of Naples originally, and he was one of the people, the families were expelled from the Kingdom of Naples, and they came north and they settled in the lower part of the Marche. So the Marca. Marca d'Ancona was the territory of this part of the state of the church. So he relocated to Civitanova. He was originally from, I found several records, archival records from the 16th century. And he was from the region Abruzzo today. That doesn't mean anything, doesn't mean, probably, I don't know how many people heard of this city before. It's called Cellino Attanasio. And he settled in Civitanova. And we don't have much information. What I found, what I was able to reconstruct, it's only thanks to the archival records, notarial records from the 16th century, economic transactions. And we have some records about the synagogue, and the cemetery, the Jewish cemetery in 1554. So this person, according to the archival records, his father was Elnatan, and was a tailor. He had a business in clothes and rags and something like that, and he was also a money lender. Not an official money lender, but it was somehow dealing with money, and I found some records about it. So this his son, so our author, Benjamin, also had a brother called Shmuel, and they were also doing the same. They were also in business with their father, Nathan. So the records I'm talking about, the archival records I'm talking about, are in Latin or sometimes in Italian. And the name of Benjamin was Guglielmo di Deodato in Italian, or Guglielmus Deodatus. And we find sometimes he was a master, a magister. So it means that was not really a master, it was someone was dealing with business, and he was considered particularly important for some reason. Guglielmo di Deodato, he appears many, many times in lots of notarial records from the time, from, I would say, 1540s to 1559 in Civitanova. And he appears in economic transactions as a money lender and as the agent. He was the agent of the main bank, lending bank in Civitanova. And he moved a lot. He was the person who was moving from city to city and bringing in money and bringing food or bringing in trading. But he also appears sometimes for the important reasons of the community. It was not a Parnas. I mean, as far as I know, we don't have a clear information because Civitanova was a small community. So we don't have information, clear information about the rabbi and about the parnasim of the community. But he was considered an important person because he appeared many, many times for the, for example, the establishment of the synagogue, or the establishment of the Jewish cemetery, of the perimeter of the Jewish cemetery. So he is always there. Let's say that. We don't know anything about his education. That was really something I wanted to know. We don't know exactly what the curriculum of a Jewish person, of a moneylender in the 16th century would have been. How this person came to write a chronicle about the Pope, it's still unclear. So in my book, in my PhD thesis, I was trying to reconstruct that. On the basis of some sources of some records from the archives, I found it was somehow interested in books. And he also appeared in some economic transactions where he bought some books, he traded some books and some Bibles for some other, I mean, for in exchange of a vineyard or something like that. I don't remember exactly right now. But yeah, there were some transactions, some records about that. So it tells something to us. It tells that this person could value manuscripts, could value a Bible. But again, we don't know exactly where about this library. We don't know his sources. Yeah, this is something I would really love to discover at some point.
Right. I mean, if you read the chronicle, you do see he has a lot of, I think it's like psukim. So he was learned. He wasn't, he knew a little bit. But yeah, it would be interesting to know. So, I mean, does he say, why did he write the chronicle? What was his purpose of writing this chronicle? Was it just something he witnessed, he wanted to write down? What was his purpose of writing it?
Yeah, he wrote several times, he writes that he wanted to keep this testimony of what happened to the Jews under Paul the First. For the future generations, for probably for his family or for some other people from other countries or other lands. But this was not really meant to be published, of course, because it would have been straight to the Inquisition and straight to the stake. It really intended to write this for the family, for the future generations of the family.
Right, because like you said, I alluded to this earlier. I mean, in today's English, you would say he cursed them out. He was cursing out Paul the whole time. You can't publish that. He was really, Paul was a hated figure by the Jews, and rightfully so, but, it's not something you could publish. So, I mean, we already alluded to the beginning of the chronicle. So we mentioned how it discusses the bull and then the situation of the burning of the Muranos on Kiddush Hashem. But what else does the chronicle discuss after that? And what are there any like memorable passages other than that memorable thing that jumps out to you besides for this?
Yeah. So I would say the first part, the chronicle is articulated into 8 chapters. The first 4 or 5, we think we already talk about, because it was really about the Pope and what happened to the Jews at a macro level. So what was the situation with the communis absurdum and the burning at the stake of the conversus? We talk about the war of the Pope against
Sorry, a little bit of a connection issue. So let's repeat the, go back to the question of, what is discussed and any, it's memorable passages from the rest of the chronicle.
Yes. So the chronicle is articulated into 8 chapters. So the first 4 and beginning of the 5th chapters are really talking about the general situation of the Jews and the papacy of Paul the First. So what happened from the very beginning, the issue of the communis absurdum, the burning at the stake of the Portuguese conversos in Ancona. Then it talks about the war of Paul the First against Charles the Fifth and Philip the Second, so the emperor and the king of Spain, very much with many details. Because as you said in the introduction, and I think also in the last part of the Khatima, it really wanted to talk about the Pope in detail. Because this work was not, this chronicle was not on the Jews, was on the Pope. And so he said somehow it is important to talk about what he did, even if he didn't really involve the participation in the war. Then, the second part of the chronicle, so in the last 4 chapters, he talks more in detail about his own situation, his own what he saw with his own eyes and what happened to the Jews in Civitanova, which was a very small city, a very small community. And he talks about the situation in Civitanova, but also in the surroundings, so in the Marca. And talks about many other communities, not only the community of Macerata, it's also it's the biggest city close to Civitanova. It talks about other little cities where people started to convert. So it talks about the conversion of the Jews because they were scared of after the communis absurdum, they were scared of what happened after what happened in 1556 in Ancona. And we have to that Ancona and Chihuahua less than 160 kilometers, 50 kilometers. So they were really concerned about that the Pope, the Roman Inquisition, would have come to Civitanova, would have come to Macerata to do the same. So, he talks about many things. And in particular, he writes what happened in Civitanova after a convert from Judaism to Christianity started to plot against the Jewish community in Civitanova. So it was this. It talks about this person who was named Giovan Battista Buonamici. It was born Aharon ben Menachem, and this person started to accusing the Jews of several things. Then it was a very long, according to what the author wrote in the chronicle, was a very long dispute. There were very many fights between the Jews and this neophyte. And these fights resulted in the involvement of the Roman Inquisition. So after one year at least of this dispute, the Roman Inquisition finally arrived and they arrested 6 Jews, included the author of the chronicle, and they were taken to from Civitanova, they were taken to Rome. So I would say one of the most important things that the author records in the chronicle is exactly the arrest. So it's the arrest and the trip that the 6 Jews took from Civitanova to Rome. And I would say it's about 300 kilometers, something like that. And they covered them in less than 1 week by foot. So by foot, sometimes we have indication of horses, but we don't know exactly what was exactly the trip in that time, how many. My PhD was really trying to make sense of it, out of it, and try to understand if it was reliable information or if it was something made up by the author or by someone else. But yeah, this was exactly what a pilgrim would have done back in the days. So it seemed a reliable information, all in all. And I could prove that in the book. I provided some examples, similar examples, and those streets were also connecting the sanctuary of Madonna di Loreto, so Santa Maria di Loreto, which is still an important sanctuary in near Civitanova, near in the Marche, and Rome. So there were pilgrims going back and forth between Rome and the Vatican and Loreto. So I mean, I was really fascinated by this account of the trip, and it really recounts remembers all the places where they stopped, and it mentions the Jewish communities. They mentioned other Jews they met along the way. And so the Jews came to bring food, to bring kosher food, because the guardians and the priests were not really giving them kosher food. So sometimes he gives descriptions of the prisons and not the prisons of the Inquisition. I mean, he gives descriptions of the prisons along the way. So sometimes they were sleeping one day in a place and the day afterwards were transferred to another prison and so on. So he does that for 7 days at least. And then when they finally arrived in Rome, they were transferred to the Roman Inquisition prison. And this is really an extraordinary description of the prison, because we don't have any sources telling us what the prisons of the Inquisition looked like. The point is that in 1559, when the Pope died, the Roman population came to the building of the Inquisition and they burned everything. So we don't have the archives, we don't have surviving books from the time, with the exception of two records of the Inquisition decisions before 1559. Aside those volumes, we don't have anything from that time. So it is really important. I mean, his chronicle, his descriptions of the prisons and descriptions of the procedures of the Inquisition and people around the Inquisition and how the prisoners were divided into the rooms, or the food. It talks about the food. Oh, this was not kosher. We couldn't eat that food. Or sometimes the bread, because it was kosher. So it was really talking about many issues around him. And he mentioned lots of, he mentions other people. He mentions other famous prisoners who were in prisons back then, and they were considered heretics by the Roman Inquisition. So they were waiting for the trial. When the Pope died in 1559, all the prisoners, including the author and the other Jews from Civitanova, were released. So we don't know exactly what happened afterwards, but I mean, in the chronicle, it talks about they came back to Civitanova, but he talked about what happened after the death of the Pope, all the big rebellion of the Roman populace against the Pope and against the church, the cardinals, and the funeral of the Pope. It talks about many, 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 many things. And it's really an extraordinary source. It's a very remarkable source to have a picture of those years. And I would say the second part is even more important, exactly for that, because for the Inquisition, we because really we don't have, I mean, as far as I know, we don't have other detailed sources about the descriptions of the prison in that time.
Right, which is all fascinating. And I had two other questions I was going to ask you that I think really answered with that whole answer, which is, first of all, what is special about the Chronicle? And I think it's what you just said, you know, it's really what makes it so special and unique. And the other one you can kind of talk about a little bit, we kind of alluded to a lot of it, which is the sources, the language, and the style of the Chronicle. But, you know, it's kind of a lot of what you just said, and he's very vivid. He's a very descriptive writer. There's a lot of vivid descriptions. I was gonna say enjoyable read, but not enjoyable. I mean, it's enjoyable. It's engrossing, but it's dark, but it's enjoyable in that regard to read what he's writing, whether in Hebrew or in the English, your translation. But I mean, if you want to talk about a little bit about the sources, his language or his style, I mean, you can just mention.
Yeah, sure. So for sure, we don't have much information about his sources, what he was really reading back then, but for sure, he knew the Bible very, very much. he quotes the Bible many, many times. And his language is really influenced by the biblical language. So that's why it was also easy for me to translate. I mean, as a non-Hebrew speaker. And so, yeah, you can see, it's possible to see the influence of the Bible. Sometimes he quotes the Talmud, although he was not supposed to know the Talmud. And so, yeah, we have some other references to other books. But of course, it was influenced by non-Jewish sources. So, for example, when he talks about the vacancy of the papal state when Paul IV died, so it means the vacancy of the Holy See. So when the Pope dies and the time between the death of the Pope and the election of the successor, it was really relying a lot on the information he had from friends and his own testimony as an eyewitness. And testimonies of other friends, but I think also the Avisi, so the newsletters that were circulating, so kind of gazettes sold by informers to, I would say, something like journals and newspapers that were circulating news. So in this news, sometimes we find. We can find a parallel. They can be compared. And about the language, yes, it's, of course, it was an Italian Jewish person. It was very much influenced by the Italian dialect. But again, we don't know exactly which language they were talking. For sure, he knew Italian. They knew the Italian dialect of his place. And it was really transliterating some words into Italian, I mean, Italian words into Hebrew. So in the Chronicle, it's possible to see some Italian words, like, for example, when he talks about the funeral, he says, Paul IV died and he didn't receive a funerale superbissimo. So it means he didn't have a grand funeral like the other popes before him. And he had many, many other instances. There are many other instances in the Chronicle where he uses Italian, in proper Italian. Yeah.
Right. And he's right. It's written in Hebrew. It's not written in actual Italian. Yeah. So are there any other just similarities or novelties of the Chronicle when you compare it to other medieval, you know, early modern, the Jewish historiography? Is it similar or does it differ from those?
Yeah, sometimes it says, yeah, the whole situation we are living in is exactly can be explained because of our sins. So this was a really topos of a medieval Jewish historiography where people, I mean, Spanish authors were complaining about the situation of the Jews and Galut Sfarad and saying, this is our fault. This is because of our sins. And this is something that really, it's always there. So even in the 16th century, even in his Chronicle, although he tries to be, to give an account of the papacy of Paul the First is still there. I mean, he's still thinking about. He has a model of these medieval chronicles, and also about. Also, one of his models is still the like, for example, the Shochet Kabbalah, and the scroll. So how this miracle salvation can be compared to the story of Esther, to the story of Purim. So, you know, this happened, but we also had a miracle, and this happened because, you know, and there are also some references to the story of Esther, because sometimes it talks about some evil. So Paul the First is considered Paul the First's nephew is many times is considered as evil as Aman, and sometimes there are references to other evil people, famous people, famous enemies of the Jews, like Amalek. Sometimes they say, yeah, it was in the company of Amalek and Balaam. So there are some. This kind of references, or sometimes the Pharaoh, there are some similarities. So he uses these metaphors to explain the evil people against the Jews. Novelties, yes. I mean, of course, this more mature concept of writing history, I would say that. And this was, of course, not perceived by the author, probably. This is what we can perceive about the chronicle itself. So it's a consideration we can do. But I would say it's still an author who's trying to write something more than a Jewish account about Jews, about the Jews, is trying to do something else. And as far as I know, I don't know, there are other works, Jewish biographies of a pope. So it's something that's really stands out.
Right. I think that would be interesting. So just to finish up on Paul the Fourth, like you already said, when he died, there was a vacancy, so there was a lot of rioting going on, and it wasn't only the Jews that really hated him. He obviously at that point was hated by a lot of the population. So talk a little bit about that, and talk about the, I think I could say the unfortunate rehabilitation of his image after that, but because he thankfully is not a saint, but why don't you, he would never made into one, meaning you want to just speak a little bit about that, just to finish up discussing Paul.
Yeah. So when Paul the Fourth died in August 1559, so the Roman populace came down to the streets and they opened all the prisons and they released all the prisoners. And one of the first things they did was also going to the Capitol, and they tore down the statue of the Pope, the statues of popes. But this statue was just inaugurated a couple of years before, a couple of months before. So it costed a lot. So we have lots of sources about this, about the cost of the statue and the cost for the sculpture. Anyway, they in this both in the chronicle and in other sources and other chronicles from the time, Italian sources, we have these descriptions of this statue. And first they remove the leg, they remove the nose, they remove the arms and whatever. Then the children took the head, and they took this head in the marketplaces. They wanted to throw it in the river, so it was a lot of things going on, and also the chronicler Benjamin went to see this statue, and he writes about it. But yeah, so there are many things that happened after the death, after Paul I's death. And in 1560, after a very long conclave, so the conclave is the meeting of the cardinal, the formal meeting of the cardinals that gather all together in Rome, and still nowadays, when a pope dies. And so they gather together to elect the new pope. So after, I would say, 6 months, something like that, they finally, the cardinals in 1559 finally decided to elect a new pope, Pius I. And he was not exactly pious with the family of the pope. So because even when Paul I was still alive in 1559, he expelled from the court all his nephews. So all because he found out that these people, these relatives were not living in a saint way, in a moral way, and the cardinal nephew had many women and he was indulging many, many vices and many, many things. So at some point really, and he found out also one of the other nephews were responsible for the murder of his wife. So all these people were expelled by from the Vatican. And when he died, when Paul I died, he was kind of rehabilitated by Pius I, because he decided to put them all in trial for several murders and for several crimes they committed, and also for taking money out of the palace when Paul I died. So there were many, many accusations against them, and finally they were all executed and they died. So after the death of the Carafa, the Carafa family, the Carafa nephews, Paul I was rehabilitated. In some way, he was seen as the victim of the story. And he was kind of manipulated by his nephews. And so he somehow, Pius I, started to rehabilitate his figure by saying he was not a bad guy after all. What he did all for the church, and he did for the moral reformation of customs within the church and outside the Catholic body. So yeah, but during the centuries, people didn't really think about making him a saint. Luckily, I would add. So it was not canonized, and his body was transferred to a church. So before, it was buried in St. Peter, and after some years, it was transferred to the church of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva in Rome, and it's very close to the Pantheon in Rome. It's possible to visit the tomb if you want to.
I don't think anyone wants to. And if you read the chronicle, like he says, I mean, he goes on and he heaps on him. Oh my gosh. His image shouldn't have been rehabilitated, but whatever. People should read the chronicle and see, what he says about him and what firsthand account of what happened, what he did to all the Jews and how it affected them. So to finish up a little bit, so the manuscript, this was published originally by Yeshaya Zona, if I'm pronouncing his name right, the scholar, and he published it originally. And now you read that, and then it was published. He has a small volume from Mossad Bialik. He has a couple of things and various popes, and it's in there. You can get it used. It's not around anymore. I got a used copy though. And but now you have a new critical edition, so to speak, inside of your work, which has it as well. So talk a little bit about why it wasn't published till then, about the manuscript, where it is now, just, tie everything about it, how he published it, all that, just to give people that little bit of information.
Yeah. So Zonin published the chronicle in 1931, first on Tarbitz and then Mossad Bialik 1954. It was a reprint with other sources. So the introduction of 1931, which he also kept in 1954, he said that he found the chronicle about 6 months before the publication, about the writing of the introduction. He didn't really say when, where, and who told him about this manuscript. it provided very short information, very brief information about the chronicle itself, the manuscript, and it was an 18th century, 19th century script, Italian script, cursive script. The manuscript was not something great. It's very, it's a manuscript on paper, and it's a pretty small booklet. And also, yeah, I also wanted to put the facsimile edition in the in my edition, so that also people would see how the manuscript looked like, and also because I was allowed to have the rights to publish it by the National Library of Israel, where the manuscript is. So the manuscript is right now, currently is in the National Library of Israel since 1937. So Zonnes saw the manuscript before 1931, but it didn't say when and where, who, nothing. It didn't give many information. It didn't give much information. The National Library acquired the manuscript through the collection of Zygmunt Noaim, who was a German Jewish collector from Frankfurt. And he collected many manuscripts and books, but he was also very much interested into Silver Judaica, ceremonial objects that are today in the Jewish Museum of Frankfurt. So this person died 2 years after the burning of the books in Berlin in 1933. And he was living in Frankfurt, but he was also making business in Milan. And he was living in Italy for some time during the years in 1920s and 1930s. So he was someone aware of the situation both in Germany and Italy. And at some point he decided to donate the books to the National Library, to the University Library of the Hebrew University. So that's why the books came to Jerusalem. And thank God they came, because many other Jewish collections of books and other objects were destroyed or confiscated by fascists and Nazis. So again, we don't know. What I did in my research was trying to find a link between Zonnes and Noaim, which I didn't find. So the thing, my hypothesis, what I've written in the book is that Zonnes and Noaim didn't know each other directly, but they had some mutual acquaintances. It might be possible that Zonnes saw this manuscript in 1930. And on the basis of some letters I found in the Zonnes archives in Cincinnati and Jerusalem, he saw this manuscript because he wanted to buy it, but he didn't manage. So it might be possible that the person who was selling the manuscript sold it to Noaim, but he was also asking for some expertise by Zonnes about the manuscript. So Zonnes was allowed to see and copy the manuscript, but he didn't manage to buy it because it was already sold. And he didn't know the name of the purchaser. So that's why they didn't know each other, and we don't have references of that. But when Zonnes wrote the article in 1931, he published the chronicle in 1931, but he was also publishing another article on the episodes of Ancona in 1556. And this article was on the Revue des Etudes Juives. He writes in a footnote that he came to know that the owner of the manuscript was Zygmunt Noaim, and he sent his appreciation to him, but nothing more. So yeah, they didn't know each other. They had some mutual acquaintances, some probably a book dealer or an antiquarian, something like that. This is what I think.
Right, and Zona, I think, says he copied it in one day or something. I mean, it's not a big manuscript. And also, just to be clear also about it, this is the only, the manuscript is only one copy in the world, and also it's not the original, it's a copy of the original, just to be clear for the listeners on that. So I think that more or less covers a lot of it. Obviously, there's a lot more on this topic, a lot more complicated, more in-depth. So your book, like I said, it has a chapter on the Jews, and I'm going to butcher the name again, Civitanova, I guess now some of it got it, and it talks about the Chronicle, and it goes through the popes and the Jews, and then it has, like I said, the critical annotated, translated with Hebrew and the English edition of the Chronicle, plus the facsimile. I mean, there's just, tons in there. It's only, the only problem, I'm just going to say, it's a Brill book, so it's very expensive. But other than that, it's a fascinating book. So I guess just finish off any, current research that you're working on now.
Yeah, I'm working on Zone. So, it was a big surprise for me, because when I was working on the PhD, I was not really thinking about shifting my interests to 20th century Jewish history. So I was trained as an early modern historian. I was working in 16th century and Jewish sources, historiography. I was not really planning on writing a biography of a Jewish scholar from the 20th century. So, but yeah, here I am. I'm working on the biography. I really think that Zone was a neglected scholar in his time and afterwards. It was a pioneering figure for the study of the Italian Renaissance and Italian Jewry in the 16th century, but also in the history of Jewish printing. So that's why I really started my research in Cincinnati and Jerusalem to work on his archives and papers, correspondence, and also his collection of manuscripts and books, early printed books.
And I believe you just published, there was just a brand new article that came out from you?
Yeah.
Okay, so that one is free, so I can link actually to that in the, right? I can link to that article, it's open access in podcast notes, as well as linking to the book. So with that, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you for a fascinating show. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.